Hello, and welcome to Torah in Motion's MP3 audio library. We hope you enjoy this recording of a live Torah in Motion presentation. For more information, please visit www.torahinmotion.org. Thank you.
Our next speaker, Rabbi Wolf, Rabbi Dr. Wolf, I just want to mention, I know it's a couple weeks, you know, before Pesach, as we of course know, but we actually have a busy week, and for those who have time and are available, we're having on Thursday night our third part of the series. For those who are at the first two parts on challenges in the State of Israel, and Rabbi Moshe Tarrigan, who's a Rebbe at Har Etzion, he's very good, is going to be talking on secular Zionism as a tool of our Geula. We talk about how Pesach is the original redemption. He's been talking how secular Zionism ties into that. I don't think he's going to talk on the election on Tuesday night, but at least I sure hope not. Anyway, so that's on Thursday night. And next Sunday night, we're having a program on business ethics, on making money, a case of ethics, with the two people who are really running the Center of Business Ethics in Yerushalayim, Asher Meir and Pinchas Rosenstein. So we're going to have a case study in business ethics that we're going to talk about. It's a very important topic. As a matter of fact, it says in the Torah that the reason Hashem took us out of Egypt, in Parsha Kedoshim, it talks about because of the weights. You have to have honest weights, and that's why I took you out of Egypt. It's an amazing, and Rashi comments, the reason God took us out of Egypt was to be honest in our monetary dealings. So it also ties into Pesach. So that's a week tonight, 8 o'clock. Both events are 8 o'clock here at Shartz Villa. Okay. Rabbi Wolf, Dr. Wolf, who we had here last year, the pleasure of having last year, we were thinking the next time you come, you can talk about his experience of two of the giants of our generation, perhaps very, very, very different, but really two of the leaders. He has smicha both from Rav Soloveitchik and Rabbi Felder, which I imagine a unique combination. There are not too many people like that. While he was at Harvard getting his PhD in Jewish history, I believe, in medieval Jewish history, he learned with the Rav in Boston and got smicha. He came to Toronto and would learn with, you know, Rabbi Felder on a regular basis. He now lives in Israel in Efrat. He's been living in Israel 15, 18 years, I believe. How many years? 13 years. All right. In a few years, it'll be 15, 18 years. And he teaches at Bar-Ilan University, and he's very involved in the modern Orthodox world and many of the causes. And anybody who's into blogs, I know he has a blog site. I don't even know what it's called. My overthrow. I don't know what these from these things. These are the new things in the world of the internet. Without further ado, it's a pleasure to introduce him to speak on art and the Haggadah.
Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. First of all, I'm really very, very happy to be here. I consider Torah in Motion to be one of the most important initiatives in the Orthodox world today, and I've put my money where my mouth is in terms of other, not my money. I don't have any money, but knowing people who do have money, I'm a little bit nonplussed. I'm really not sure what to do because the Ms. Stein gave such a trenchant and such a deep analysis, and she trumped me so often in the course of her remarks that I hope there'll be something left for me to say, so that if I hesitate, I'm looking at this at my notes and realizing that in fact we're going to have to go in directions I hadn't planned, which is a tribute, and it's a very humbling experience, and it's a tribute to her. Do these, pass these out, just pass these around. Okay, yeah, well, you know. Although there is a metaphysical rule, I discovered after all these years of teaching that the more you make, the less people come, and the less copies you make, the more people come. I am still hoping to have the rule, what should we say, violated or disproven today. Before starting, I would like to add my own two cents on the question that Ilana mentioned earlier, on the question of why is the Haggadah based fundamentally upon the the text of Aram Yoved Avi, the confessional that one recites when one brings the first fruits, the Bikurim. One of the striking parts of that passage, which was actually advocated by Chazal, that was the preferred text. One of the striking parts of that text is the fact that Matan Torah does not appear therein. The story of the exodus from Egypt that's contained in Aram Yoved Avi does not mention Matan Torah. It's a stunning omission, and has led to not a small amount of thought and not a small amount of commentary. What is there, but which we don't mention, is the fact that it concludes with the entry into the land of Israel. I can't be a visiting Israeli without commenting that what the implication appears to be is that certainly no one was meant to slough over or slide over Matan Torah. I think the point is that the ultimate goal of Yetzias Mitzrayim was the implementation of the Torah in the land of Israel, for which everything else is simply prefatory. I think it speaks to the position of the Ramban, whatever that means. I still don't know after a lot of years of thinking about it, that mitzvos and chutz laaretz are midrabbanan, that commandments outside the land of Israel are of a lesser reality, a lesser perhaps validity than they are. They're mere reminders of the kind of life once you'd organize the land of Israel. That actually would in turn speak to yesterday's parsha, yesterday's special parsha, Parsha Sachodesh. The Rambam comments on two occasions with regard to the commandment to sanctify the new moon, that ultimately the calendar, which is one of the most important things we have in Jewish life, it may in fact be that together with personal status, the most important element in Jewish identity, the calendar is determined by the Jews who live in Israel. And the Rambam goes one step further. He says in the Mishnah Torah, he said it previously in the Book of Commandments, that were there not to be any Jews in the land of Israel, the calendar would collapse. You could sit and calculate all day long and all night long, and you could have all the butchers and all the funeral directors and all the supermarkets print up all the calendars and send them out and so on and so forth. And you could have all the yeshivas send you with envelopes to return, but the calendars are invalid unless there are Jews in the land of Israel following that calendar. Because reality, religious reality, is in the land of Israel, and everything else is derivative. I think that ultimately is part of the point of bringing a Aram Yoved Avi. Yes.
Maybe the Ramban could be understood. Not that it's the Rabbanah, but in essence, God would have not created those mitzvahs per se outside Israel. There's the fundamental, the ultimate mitzvah is in Israel. The rest are sort of a Torah remembrance.
Well, that's what he says. That's Tzivilach Tziyunim. Right, that's correct. That's what I was hinting at, but since it's not my issue, I didn't want to go into depth. Thank you. In any event, art in the Haggadah. In order to understand the issue of art in the Haggadah is probably, together with the Megillah and Ksubas, the single most illuminated, it's also illuminating, but it's the single most illuminated and illustrated book that there is. Okay? Now, a lot of medieval Jewish art, of course, Jews and representative art's a whole other topic, but Jewish art generally, when it comes to book illumination, is generally confined to frontispieces, to cover pages. Generally, we don't illustrate entire books. The most prominent exception to that is the Haggadah. So the question has to be begged, why? Why is that? There are a number of reasons for that, and I need to, it's like the Darshan, the Maggid used to come to town and say, Eider Eider Vilhzogna Por Werther, before speaking, I'd like to say a few words. So, similarly, before we jump into the art, I have to preface a couple of remarks. Number one, the Haggadah is prefaced, as the Rav Zatzal used to point out very, very often, the Haggadah is prefaced on a specific type of time consciousness and time awareness, which is very, very different and stands in stark contrast to that of modernity. Modernity sees time as linear. The past, therefore, is dead. It's in the past. It's there. It's gone. It's irretrievable. Okay, it's one of the reasons why archaeology as a science is actually a modern invention, because what archaeology is essentially is the physical pathology of the past. One does not require does not require physical remains and physical proofs of things if things are felt to be living. Okay? What is the Jewish sense of past? So here, interestingly, the Rav comes together with sort of funny bedfellows. People like religious anthropologists like Mircea Eliade and others who speak of a permanent present. Classic work by Eliade is The Myth of the Eternal Return. He basically got away with writing the same book four or five times and so on. But we'll stick with the Rav because Eliade was a fascist and probably was a Nazi. So let's keep him out of the conversation. In any event, the Rav on a number of occasions, following this kind of line of analysis, points out the fact that the Jews experience time in two ways. First of all, obviously, we experience time that time goes forward. At the same time, our sense of time, our time perception is in fact fluid. We can go forward in time. We can go backward in time. The entire, in Isha Halacha, the Rav points out that the entire institution of tshuva, of repentance, is predicated upon the idea that you can go back and rectify the past. Because it's not just a matter of, say you stole something. When a person steals something, halakhically, two things happen. First of all, he becomes disqualified because he's a sinner. And second of all, he owes reparations to the person from whom he stole. So I can now, if I live in the present, I can restore what I stole. But I can't undo what I did. I did it. Halacha teaches, the mitzvah of tshuva teaches, no, on the contrary, you can go back and you can undo your sin. That's the implication of the statement in the prophet that you can turn your red, your scarlet thread of iniquity into white, pure, clean cloth. Similarly, Jewish perceptions of history are fluid. We do not relate to the past as dead. We do not relate to the past as long gone. On the contrary, we live in a permanent present where the distant past is immediately accessible. I actually didn't need the Rav to teach me that. I learned that from a little old Yerushalmi lady at Kever Rachel. She was, it was in the old days when Kever Rachel didn't look like Fort Knox. But I've never seen Fort Knox, but I imagine. Kever Rachel I've seen. In any event, there was a little Yerushalmi lady who was sitting, in the days before there was a fancy mechitza there too. Rachel wasn't really that religious, so they had to put a mechitza there. It's all to do. Any event, this Yerushalmi lady is sitting there talking to Rachel Imenu, talking to our mother Rachel, like she was her best friend. You wouldn't know that this lady, that Rachel Imenu died. How much is 1700 and 1700 and 2100? It's 3,800 years ago. You wouldn't know it. You'd think it was her next door neighbor, just Mrs. Ginsburg, who just died yesterday. I hope there's nobody named Ginsburg here. Okay. Because the past is imminently accessible, all right? The Haggadah, and I recommend there's a recent collection of the Rav's essays which just came out, which highlights some of this. The first level of understanding, there was said before about experience. The first element of the Haggadah is in fact the smashing of the limitations of time and space in the interest of becoming a Yotzei Mimitzrayim, of becoming somebody who was liberated from Egypt. That's what B'chol Dor V'Dor Chayav Adam L'Rosas Atzom Mi'Kilu Yatzam Mitzrayim means. It means you have to get out of your own head, if to use contemporary parlance, or used to be contemporary parlance, but I have no idea since I live in Israel and I don't keep up with the latest slang. You have to get out of your frame of mind and you have to identify as much as possible to try to understand what it meant to be a Yotzei Mitzrayim. Okay? That's one level. You have to experience that moment. This is a permanent element of Jewish time consciousness and holiday consciousness. Similar type of thing comes up on Tisha B'Av. We say on Tisha B'Av at night, after we read Megillas Eicha, we say, B'leil ze yifkayun emunai. Tonight we are crying. Meaning this very moment it's happening. Now, if you're into Einstein's theory of relativity and time is really fluid physically, then you could really let yourself go and say, wow, it really is happening in a different dimension right this minute as it's going on. So you can take it one step further. I remember feeling that way when I had my Moses experience. You know, you can't have a Moses experience in Israel by definition, right? But I had an opportunity to be on Har Nevo, And it was a really transformative moment. So you're thinking, wow, according to Einstein, Moses is really standing here looking at the land as we're standing. It was a little, I started getting weird. My wife said, stop it. Okay. In any event. The point, therefore, being that on one level, you have to go back on the past. On the other hand, it is not possible to transcend yourself. David Moss, in his very expensive but very beautiful Haggadah, when he comes to Bechol Dor Vador Chayav Adam Leros Das Mokiulo Yatzam Mitzrayim, has... Anybody ever see the Haggadah? Okay, so what is it? He has mirrors. The idea being that you see yourself. There's a didactic element in this mirror. It's not just a cutesy thing. Moss does his homework. In fact, he just published an entire book describing many of the ksubas that he did, and you see the kind of work and thought that went into things in terms of research and midrashim and gemaras and so on. It's a very, very learned piece of work. His ksubas are, and certainly this Haggadah is. What's the point? I see myself in the mirror means I see me. I have to ask what this stuff means to me and how it is reflected in my experience of the Haggadah. So it's a two-tier business whenever you encounter the Haggadah. You become somebody else, you transcend yourself, and at the same time, you must indeed encounter on your terms what the Haggadah stands for. Okay? So that's number one. For purposes of artistic representation, okay, as we'll see and hopefully see in a few minutes, the artistic representation is of the latter type. When Jews either commissioned non-Jews to illuminate Haggadahs or did it themselves, it's not always quite clear who did what. Usually when there's a physical portrayal of God in a Haggadah, you assume it's not a Jew, but you never know. Goy Shekup. In any event, that's usually a photo of how the person doing the illumination and the society out of which it grew, because you're always doing it as a Polaroid of, those of you who remember what Polaroids are, as a digital camera shot of that immediate moment of Jewish life. That's where it comes from. By the way, okay, leads to number two. Not only is the Haggadah the most illuminated document in the Jewish library, it is also the most commented upon. But it is commented upon in a very unique way. My friend, colleague, and teacher, Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, likes to call the Haggadah a plastic text. Plastic text means that there are certain texts where when you interpret them, like Chumash, or the Gemara, you're very, very much restricted by the context and the nature and the formulations and the words and the exegetical needs of the text and so on. So yes, you may bring a certain amount of yourself to understanding what Chumash is saying, but nevertheless, you don't have a lot of room to move. You don't have a lot of you don't have a lot of wiggle room. Certainly not maximal wiggle room. Okay? The Haggadah, like Pirkei Avos and others, is a text which is so straightforward, or so unclear, one of the two, that indeed, very often, more often than not, commentators will pour themselves into what they're describing far more than you'll find elsewhere. Okay? And they will see themselves, again, the second level, see themselves in what happens. Classic example is the famous Haggadah Zevach Pesach by Don Yitzchak Abravanel. Don Yitzchak Abravanel wrote his Haggadah in the years between 1492, it was published in 1497 in Napoli, after the expulsion from Spain. In other words, he grappled with the text of the Haggadah in his own prolix, verbose way. You don't have a whole Seder. One Seder is not enough to read this whole thing, but in any event, I don't know what he had in mind. Because he had two Siddharim. Oh, you guys have two Siddharim. You can do it. I can't manage. That's another reason to come. In any event, oh, by the way, on the question of do you miss the second Seder, the answer is no. Abravanel was grappling with the issues of galut, of exile and redemption and freedom and so on, while he's on the boat, leaving Spain, going to southern Italy, and then Napoli, the kingdom of Naples is conquered by is conquered by the Spanish Infanta, and this Inquisition is brought to southern Italy, and therefore he has to move to northern Italy and ends up in Venice. And I mean, it's not a fun life. And he's dealing with this during the entire time. So I'll give you an example of how, in fact, this plays itself out. And you have to hear the historical echoes while you're reading the commentary. He writes in one place, I think Ilana mentioned it before. Mercy. Oh, great. The Haggadah begins with the, among other things, with the statement that even if we were all, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu hadn't taken us out of Egypt, we would still be slaves to Pharaoh, whatever that means. So Rabbi Ravenel said, maybe it would have been better. So what? What did we gain? What benefit do we receive from the fact that went out of Egypt? Maybe we would have been better off in Egypt. Maybe we would have been enfranchised in Egypt. As opposed to now where we go from exile to exile and from shmad to shmad and from persecution to persecution, especially in light of the experience in Spain. It's clear when it comes to mass apostasy, mass conversion, and forced conversion. Okay? In other words, this is a moment in which a person is right now struggling with the fact of the cognitive dissonance which exists between the Haggadah and its message and the personal experience of the interpreter. On the contrary, I would argue to you, and you have to listen to these historical whispers while you're reading commentaries, and Rabbi Artscroll has destroyed them. Okay? Rabbi Artscroll is just totally... All right, I'm not going to start. In any event, if there was a holiday which is the most creative, the most tense, the most problematic for a Jew in a non-emancipated society, in a pre-modern society, it's Pesach. Because there's an absolute contradiction between what you're celebrating and what you have outside. The best... One example is the fact that the Taz, Reb David Halevi, comments that it is true that when it comes to, if you have a pecking order of wines, that halakhically red wine is preferable to white wine. I have to like white wine, but all right. It's preferable to white wine. Why? Because it has more substance. It has more body. It has more regal. It has a more of a regal nature. It's purple or whatever. Chaylus is not purple, of course, we all know, but now... But it has more distinction, and therefore you should use that. As the Taz, however, in the 17th century, at the time of Tachvatat, at the time of the Chmielnitsky massacres, and so on, in the same Poland that my father-in-law used to say was a Gan Eden, you have to use red wine. However, if there's a possibility that there's going to be a blood libel, you should use white wine, lest they accuse the Jew that he's drinking Christian blood. Now, understand what... And I remember there was you put out a student Haggadah many years ago, and they had a little thing saying, well, if there's going to be a blood libel, you should use red wine. You know, it was like this. You missed the point. The point is that, what kind of thing is that? I'm celebrating freedom, and I'm tittering, because I don't know if there's going to be spies that are going to say that the red wine is Christian blood. So you have to look for these moments of contemporary nuance in the Pefarshim, because that gives you an insight into not the way that people experienced being freed slaves, but how they experienced this moment of dealing with the problematics of the Haggadah. Final preparatory point, just a point about art. And I'd ask you, please, now you can take out the sheets. Jews, I mean, in Israel, it's a big deal now to talk about the development of a Jewish religious artistic tradition and so on. The past history of Jewish plastic arts, especially representational arts, is somewhat dicey. There's a whole question to what degree there was an endemic Jewish tradition, to what degree there were borrowings, and the illustrations in the Haggadah raises the broader question of the impact of non-Jewish society and non-Jewish culture on Judaism. Okay? I'll give you a very, very famous and really striking example. This page here. We're going to talk all about the four sons today, basically. But, okay? Anybody, you see the picture down at the bottom? Okay? He's the Chacham. This picture of the Chacham pops up all over the place. literally all over the place. Okay? It's consistently, once somebody went and made the woodcut, it keeps popping up and popping up. All right? Does that picture look familiar? Do you know who that is? You know. Okay, you know. Well, it's not really Socrates, but yeah, it's not Socrates, actually. Okay? Who is it? What? No, the thinker is like this. No. No. Oh! Very nice. This is a woodcut version of the portrait of Archimedes. I think it's Archimedes. In the Academy of Plato by Raphael. There's a picture, you'll recall, Leonardo is actually Plato. He's going like this. And I don't remember I don't know who does Aristotle, but he's going like this at the top of the thing. At the bottom is from life representation, because Michelangelo lived to be like 80, 85, and Raphael died relatively young. This is a portrait of Michelangelo that is it's three chambers away from the Cappella Sistina, from the Sistine Chapel, in which he's sitting like this. Okay? So, but look what they did. They went, what addition did the artist make? He put a Jewish hat, this is the typical kind of German Jewish hat the Jews had to wear instead of a Jew badge, stuck it on his head, and Michelangelo became the Chacham. Okay? Now, what does that tell me? Okay, what do I learn from this? Okay? What do I learn from this? No, tell me. Now that I know the secret of this little picture. He's not thinking about a sugya, Michelangelo. No? The simplest answer is always the correct answer. That's always the case. No? No, before we get to that. It means that somebody went to the Sistine Chapel. It means that a Jew went to the Sistine Chapel. Okay? Now, how could you say that Kedoshi Yisrael, that they went to the Sistine Chapel? So first of all, Vasari in his History of the Painters writes that when the Jews were put in the ghetto in Rome in the 1530s, they were, no, I'm sorry, the Roman ghetto was 1555, my mistake. They were only allowed out during the day. And Shabbos afternoon, they would take a Shabbos Spatzir, but they had to be back for Mincha, not because they had Davin, well, they had Davin too, but because they had to lock the gates of the ghetto. So the Shabbos, they had to take a Shabbos Spatzir, which would allow them to go out and come back. So those of you, anybody, people have been to Rome? So so the ghetto, for those of you who know, the ghetto area, okay, is right on the Tiber. Okay? The Moses of Michelangelo is in San Pietro in Ingolo, St. Peter in chains. You can see it because there are all the Jews selling, crucifixes and stuff like that right in front of it. You go right up the Via Rossa. And it's a nice walk, but it's not doable. Vasari writes, the Shabbos afternoon, the Rav and the whole community, that was the Spatir. They would go to San Pietro in Vincolo and they would go see the Moses. Because when you go to see the Moses, obviously I'm going to tell you that I went also, you go in, the altar is here, and to the right is the Moses. Raising interesting questions, because the only way you can see it, it's very dark. You have to put money in, you have to question whether you want to give money to a Vodazar, that's another story. In any event, so clearly the Italian Jews went to see these artistic works, and in fact they commissioned him, had no problem with including this this Gerzedek, Moshe Michelangelo, in the Haggadah. Yeah. Because I don't know for fact, but I know for a fact that they were there, so it's certainly reasonable. And there were enough Jews who did, in fact, have entree to the papal court that it certainly would not have gone unnoticed that this was the Michelangelo. That's for sure. Okay? So the question then gets raised. Okay? So now we know where this comes from. So what is this? Is this a Jewish image? Or is this, as Chernyakhovsky would put it, I'm reversing Chernyakhovsky. Chernyakhovsky talks about throwing tefillin on the statue of Apollo. He means the opposite. But, or is this sort of like something of a form of shatnez? Yeah. Why? Okay, you're right. Because when we talk about non-Jewish influence on Judaism, it's not people who are have an agenda. To say that Judaism has to be adapted whole hog without any, without giving any thought to the integrity of Jewish tradition, they'll say, well, that's outside influence. Well, that's from the Goyim. That doesn't count. Influence is much more subtle. Okay? Everybody in this room is influenced. Okay? Everybody in this room eats 3 meals a day. Okay? Chazal ate 2 meals a day. If we were really going to be loyal to the traditions of our ancestors, we should have 2 meals a day, one in the morning and one in the afternoon. That's it. But we eat 3 meals a day. Nobody in this room, everybody in this room, I should say, has accepted the hegemony of the cabal of, not Kabbalah, that's something else, the cabal of designers in Paris who decide who dictate what we're going to wear. Because they dictate what gets manufactured, and the manufacturers dictate what goes in the stores, and the stores decide that determine what we buy. So we're influenced. The question is, not are we influenced? All minority groups are influenced. All groups are influenced. The question is, A, what gets adopted by the Jewish community? In what form? And to what degree are those things acculturated and adapted to our values? Okay? That's the issue that has to be maintained. To what degree do we convert? Do we domesticate things from the outside? So here you have an image which comes from Michelangelo, which comes from Raphael, I have to give credit where credit is due, but which has become Judaized, integrated into the Haggadah. And when I open the Haggadah, he looks, we'll take a look at other pictures of the Chacham as we go through the other illuminations, he doesn't look all that much different than the other pictures of, Tyre Talmid Chachamim that are portrayed in other Haggadahs. Okay? So, what the Haggadah is all, one thing that the Haggadah is a meeting place in which, if you wish to use John Henry Newman, the best of what is exists in the outside world of art has found a home for an authentic Jewish purpose within the framework of Jewish religious self-expression. So that's number one. Number two, and this I'm going to say very briefly because I really do want to get to the pictures. Art is a funny thing. There's a French philosopher whose name is Baudrillard. Baudrillard wrote a book called America. He wrote about his reflections on life in America and the internet and so on. So one of the things he points out, and the truth of the matter is his Chiddush, the Chiddush belongs to Mal in the Gothic image, that people in the Middle Ages were not uneducated. People in the Middle Ages, not Jews, the non-Jews, were not uneducated. They were illiterate. They couldn't read or write, but they were not uneducated. Because they learned, and they knew things. How they learned? They learned either orally from preachers who would give sermons, or they learned the art of reading the cathedrals. Those of you who studied architecture or medieval art know that the cathedrals are built in a very, very precise manner, and if you read them properly, you can get a full Catholic education. You can learn all about salvation, and you can learn about the pecking order between the Old Testament and the New Testament. You can learn about the place of Jew in society. You can learn all kinds of things simply by images. The difference between reading and writing and getting one's education by reading cathedrals is that when you read, you have to decode, you have to process, and then you internalize. That gives you an opportunity to be able to critically tell your critical facility kick in and think about what you're reading. When you learn by reading cathedrals or reading art, the image immediately goes to the back of your brain, and it gets absorbed before your critical facility has a chance to kick in. That's why sound bites and video images are so effective, because they play straight to your gut before your brain gets to kick in. That's why they're eminently manipulable. So when you look at any form of art, especially religious art, you have to ask yourself, what is the message that this image is trying to say? Because it is no less, perhaps more, educative than pedagogic than in fact is a text. All right? Ad kan, the introduction. I would like to illustrate what I've said by going on a nice, I have half an hour, nice, leisurely stroll through the Four Sons. The Four Sons are a group that everybody likes to talk about, but it's not so simple. As Ilana pointed out so well, it's a Palestinian business. It starts in the Mechilta, it comes to the Yerushalmi, there's a big discussion of how many sons are there. There were two, there were three, there were four, there are various versions. And the question is, why are they there? Why are they in the Haggadah? And how were they perceived? How were they perceived? How were they identified? Why they're in the Haggadah seems to be pretty clear. The reason is because it says, the Mishnah says, Lefidato shel ben aviv melamdo, that you're supposed to adjust the way that you present things to the needs of the child. It has to be tailor-made. There's no such thing as one size fits all. Okay? So you either give all kinds of halachic trivia to the chacham, or you give one possibility in terms of the Russia is tough love to the Russia, and so on and so forth. Rabbi, one of the great darshanim, one of the great exegetes of the early 20th century, was Rabbi Ben Zion Sachs, who was a rav in Chicago for many years, and he was the son-in-law of Rabbi Pesach Frank. In his Haggadah, Menachem Tzion, Rabbi Sachs says that at least the four sons are at the table. The one we have to worry about is the fifth son, the one who doesn't show up at the Seder and doesn't want to come at all. That's something else to think about. In any event, I'd like to ask you, I'd like to zero in on two individuals, and we'll look at a few others as we go. The Chacham and the Rasha. Okay. Interestingly, and I don't have time, or I don't really have an answer for you, why the simple son is always shown to be a little child, designed to be either a fool or somebody who is mentally deficient, and why the one who doesn't know how to ask a question is generally portrayed as a child. There's no reason why it should be otherwise. In fact, if you take a look at the Malbim, Reb Meir Leibish Malbim, one of the great warriors against reform in Germany in the 19th century, he says that the Chacham is the Orthodox Rabbiner, and the Rosh is the reform rabbi. Okay? And he notices, of course, that the, that the answer that one gives the son who does not know to ask a question is the same answer you give to the Russia. So he says, so who's that? This is the assimilated Deutsche Bürger Mosaische Glaubens, the German citizen of the Mosaic faith, who doesn't know anything, and he thinks the Reform Rabbi knows what he's talking about, so he schlepped along, so therefore you have to give him the same answer. Okay, so he perceives, it's an exceptional example, where he perceives the one who does not ask a question in very differently than usual. But usually it's a little kid. All right. Let's start talking about the Rasha. We'll get to the Chacham in a minute. Turn the page to this very famous woodcut. This woodcut starts appearing in the 15th century. Okay, with the beginning of printing. And you have here four people. You have a very sage-looking individual wearing ancient or Middle Eastern clothing. You have a soldier who's running off holding a spear. You have a wanderer, evidently, wearing a hamantash on his head. And you got a little kid, it seems, over here. Where is this come from? This is another case of borrowing. This actually comes from a series of... It's an example of a motif that pops up consistently through Western art called the Seven Ages or the Ten Ages of Man. And in general, the use of the soldier especially is very important because in Western society, at some stage, everybody was a soldier, everybody shows virility, and so on. So you have young youth, teenagerhood, virility, a person comes into his own as a soldier, and finally, wisdom. And you have variations for various types of variations. What I want to call your attention to in this connection is the fact that throughout the Middle Ages, now, here, in terms of the original context, the soldier is a positive figure. Except for over 350 years. The soldier is consistently in the Haggadah as the Russia. He's consistently the Russia. And he pops up in different ways. They take a look at the first page. You have another Haggadah from Amsterdam. Oh, this is Prague, sorry, 1526. Again, you see on the left, the number two from the right, it's a, this is a 17th, this is, looks like a 16th century version of the Swiss guards who guard the Vatican. He's got a, he's got an axe and he's got a sword, and one day he's the Russia. Okay? So interestingly, what is a distinguished and respected, oh, I got this thing, I can walk around, a distinguished and respected member of society in Christian society, in the Haggadah becomes the Russia. In fact, I'll take it one step further. The Russia, through history, is the Jewish mother's nightmare. And since that nightmare changes, so the representation changes as well. So in this case, as my mother said, I didn't raise my son to be a soldier. Okay. Similarly, one of the ironies of living, of moving to Israel in early Middle Ages, the fact that at the age of 18, I wanted to do anything I could to stay out of the army. And when I was 38, I did everything I possibly could to get into the army. But that's the way life works. In any event, what happens over here is that, so ask the question, why is the soldier the image of evil? Why is he the Russia? First of all, Jews are powerless, at least militarily, through much of the Middle Ages. Number two, who are the people that visit retribution on Jews? It's the soldiers. It's the police. Well, there's no police, but there is the soldiers. It's the crusaders. It's the Cossacks. It's whoever it is. So therefore, what is the hero of Christian society is the absolute embodiment of fear, terror, and hatred in Jewish society. The implication. So what's got to do with the Russia? Obviously, this is the Jew who became not just a Christian, but who went over to the other side totally and became a Christian soldier who then comes back to taunt the Jew. There's a long history of types like this, by the way. It goes all the way back to ancient times. Philo of Alexandria was a great Jewish philosopher. His nephew, Tiberius Julius Alexander, became a Roman general and was camped on Mount Scopus and participated in the destruction of the temple. Okay? So says Josephus. So this is a permanent moment in the identification of the Russian, the soldier, the person of power. Okay? Turn the page. That stays there until the 20th century. With the rise of Zionism, Jewish empowerment is part of the agenda of Zionism. It doesn't just stand with Jabotinsky. It stands with, in general. All right, it's true. The Haganah was founded by Jabotinsky in 1921. But the Shomer and the precursors to the Haganah and to the Etzel and to the Lehi and to Tzal were before that. Jewish empowerment, Jewish taking up of arms becomes a positive value so that the soldier can no longer be a negative image, and it's already in the beginning of the 20th century, the Russia ceases to be a soldier. What you have here is a Haggadah, which is done by the famous Jewish artist, Sigmund Forst. This is 1949, clearly right after the founding of the State of Israel. Notice what you have in the background. You have Choma u'Migdal, you have a tower, which shows these sort of ersatz settlements that were set up overnight, like Hanita and others. Notice how the arrangement of the picture. The good guy is the soldier who's on guard. He's forewarded. You know, he's foreshort. I mean, his foreshortening is his gun comes out of the picture, as it were. He's looking forward. Notice who's on the side. A Jewish tefillin facing away. And he's not standing up, he's sitting down crouched. Okay? There seems to be, now notice he's wearing a kovet tzemach, he's a something of a pioneer, but he is clearly inferior in status and value to the soldier. Okay? In other Haggadahs, okay, the Rasha is the Frumah, because he doesn't participate in the upbuilding of the land. We'll see this in a minute. What? You know, when you talk about these guys that went to Ahmadinejad last week, you begin to wonder. About 2 weeks ago. In any event, this is a total reversal based on the perception of reality of the and the value system of the people who are doing the illustrations. Forst was a really very, very, enthusiastic Zionist. And here you have. By the way, it's not just within, so say he was maybe a secular, he wasn't a secular artist. By the way, the most famous picture from Gush Etzion under siege is the picture of the guys, of the defenders of Gush Etzion with tallis and tefillin holding rifles and looking out over the terrain from which the Jordanians will later attack. There is this sense of the army as a sacred value which finds its expression in a fundamental shift in the prototypes in the Haggadah. It's tragic, but it will be interesting to see what goes on now. Because the religious Zionist community is going through a tremendous period of paroxysm and self-doubt, specifically with regard to service in the security forces. Whether that plays itself out in the next few Haggadahs that get printed in Israel will be very, very telling in terms of the pulse of the community. Okay? So that's one type of Russia that pops up a lot. It's not the only kind of Russia. Take a look at the next page. Yes? This is not a picture of the Arba Bunin, because his Arba Bunin, I couldn't get a hold of that Haggadah. But the image, but the message is the exact same message. Okay? They're actually, I've been informed, I don't know, I haven't seen it. I was informed that the Brigade Haggadah that was done for the Jewish Brigade in North Africa in 1942 had much the same message, but I've only been able to see one page of this stenograph thing, so I can't say. Yes?
You actually saw the use of the religious Jew as the
Rasha? You know what? Let's jump ahead. Take a look. Let's see, where is it? Hope it's here. I hope I Xeroxed it. No. I have a case where, I don't have a case, I understand the story about the Rasha. The last page, however, is close enough. These four sons, this is from Tzvi Livni's Haggadah 1955 in Israel. Notice who's who. The Chacham is a sort of a kibbutz edati type with a Gemara. The one at the bottom, I'll come back to in a minute. The Tam is a guy who's recently arrived in Israel. Notice he's getting off the boat. But notice who the Rosh is. Notice who the Eino Yodea Lishol is. The one who does not ask a question. It's a Haredi. It's a Haredi. Because the Haredi kid, for all his learning, doesn't get it. He doesn't get it. He doesn't understand the significance of what's happened around him. Okay, in other words, here, the Chacham has become the Eino Yodea Lishol. Okay? So that goes in that direction. In any event, let's go back to where we were. We talked about the Jewish mother's nightmare. So this is, we'll give you a few more examples over here. But I want to give you a textual one before that. In the 13th century, one of the Italian Jewry was founded by tradition by four families which were exiled by Titus and landed near, not far from, actually, according to tradition, not far from the, those of you who know Rome, the Ospedale Ebraico, in the Trastevere. The four families are the De Pomis, the Gentilis, the Del Vecchio, and the De Rossi families. Now, some of you might have heard of Salomone De Rossi, the famous Baroque Jewish composer of synagogue music and madrigals. In any event, the Del Gentili, or the Del Imanzi family, known as Minha Navim, with a vav, not with a vet, even though they're Italians. There is kosher Chianti. It's hard to get, but it is available. And it comes in the little, basket bottles, if you want. It can be very, very authentic. Then you can put candles in it, make a nice Italian red. Anyways, another story. The author of the Shibboleth HaLeket, an important Ashkenazi-Italian code in the 13th century, was Rabbi Yehuda ben Yekutiel min ha'anavim. His brother Reb Yehuda was a very, very important Talmud Chacham, known as the Ribavon. His parish is on his parish on the Gemara and on the his parish on the Gemara is printed in the Rif very often. And Reb Binyamin is quoted by his brother, and he says, "Who's the Rasha?" Says Reb Binyamin, says that's a person who says, "Maha avoda azos lachem." What is this service to you? Avoda milashon tircha, from the point of view of hard work. And he goes on and on how difficult and useless and worthless and burdensome the Torah is in general and the Pesach and the Seder is in particular. That is an argument straight out of the Pauline epistles. The argument being that the law is of no value, it does not save, only belief saves, and a certain Galilean carpenter who went out of business. we're in shul after all. And as a result, one has to have faith, and the law is nothing but a burden. Okay, the Rambam, in fact, engages this issue also in Hilchos Shabbos and so on. So who's the Rasha? The Rasha in the 13th century Rome was a Jew who converted to Christianity and came home and started screaming and yelling that this is a worthless activity because you're not going to be saved except if you believe in Jesus. Okay? That sets the pattern for the Rasha through history. Take a look over here. This is from Chicago. It was printed in Chicago in 1879, but it certainly could reflect the Lower East Side. It could reflect the downtown Toronto. Come again. This is the one I'm showing. Sorry. Okay. So here you have. Notice here you have the Chacham is the pater familias is totally out of place. Okay, totally out of place. He's dressed like he just came from Turkey. Or he just came out of a Cecil B. DeMille biblical something or other. Okay? And he's faded, notice. He's faded. He's fading away, as is the mother. Because Americanism is taking over and the old ways are fading away. Notice that the Chacham is lined up directly with the parents in the background. He's also fading away. All right? What you have in the front, in very bold colors, dressed in modern dress, are the Rasha, the Tam, who's thumbing his nose evidently, and the one who doesn't know how to ask a question, who's watching fascinatingly, but they're both looking to the Rasha for inspiration. And what's the Rasha doing? He's sitting back with a cigarette. He's pointing and saying, "Who are you? What is this? Who needs this? This is a Jewish mother's nightmare. This is the guy who's going to be straight out. He's leaving. I don't want this. I'm going to be cool. I'm going to make money quick. I'm going to be an American and I'm going to be modern, or as they used to say in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, modern." By the way, it's not for nothing that in Haredi circles, the word modern-modern is still a curse word. It's a curse word. All right? For example, there's this website that's run by this guy, Hananya Weissman, called End the Madness. Among the mishigas that the yeshiva world plays with is the fact that they don't want to, that if a guy wears loafers and doesn't wear tie shoes, that makes him say shoe not sufficiently religious to be able to marry into a friend family, because loafers are modern. Okay? Because a friend of mine, just recently, the person I stayed with over Shabbos told me that he wants to open a yeshiva store for shoes in Lakewood for yeshiva loafers, but that's a different story. Let's go on. Okay, see another example along similar lines. Next page. Okay, this is from Mark Podwell's Freedom Haggadah. Now, those of us who remember that once Soviet Jews couldn't leave Russia, and that Motzei, I don't know if they had them here, but I know that in Boston we had every Motzei Simchas Torah, there was a freedom, there was a pro, a triple SJ rally, free Soviet Jewry. Or as a friend of mine once put it, save Soviet Jews, win valuable prizes. Notice who Podwall has as the Russia. Okay? You've got three Jews looking very Eastern European, and in the front is a commissar. the commissar, he's a Jew who became a communist. He probably works for the Yevsektsia, for those of you who don't know what it is. That was the Jewish section of the KGB, or at the time it was called the NKVD. Actually, for the time it was called the Checha, the Gapeo, but let's not be finicky. And who would actually use their Jewish knowledge to undo and to arrest rabbis and shochtim and prevent the Jewish religion from existing. He's the Russia. Because when they had samizdat, underground hatseders, this is the Russia they're afraid of. Okay, that's one experience. If you turn the page, however, Jewish mothers had in America had different ideas. Now here's the picture that Ilana quoted, which made me begin to really start wondering, and myself because whatever. What's this? The top. This comes from J.D. Eisenstein's Haggadah. The Russia is what my bubby used to call in colloquial parlance a bum. This is a Jewish kid who's going to, you know, he's scrappy. He's making up on this. It's a question of Bugsy Siegel versus some other guy made it legit. He's going to make it fast. He's going to make his money as a boxer. It's like goyish business. I mean, anybody saw? There were no Jews in Cinderella Man, except maybe people bought tickets. I don't know, but that's not what a Jew did for a living. Max Baer wasn't Jewish. For those of you who saw that movie. He was a paternalist. Well, at the time, the reform movement hadn't decided paternalist descent yet, so he was a goy. But because he had Jewish descent, so he used to wear a mug and dovet on his slacks and so on. But this was something that no Jewish mother wanted. This is the Russia. I'm going to make it not with spirit, not by my spirit, says the Lord, but by power and might and my right fist and my left uppercut. Okay, right uppercut. Okay? Or, similarly, to the left, you have, what is it, where's this from? This is also 1944. Here's the Jews going golfing. That's a golf club in his hand. So instead of studying, he's on the golf course. Okay? He wants to make it in the country club. This is just when, by the way, this is just when Jewish country clubs were being founded. It's around this time. You'll see there's a Marx Brothers version that I'm not going to comment on because it's self-explanatory. Because the wise man is Groucho, not because he's a wise man, but because he's a wise something else. Wise guy. That wasn't what I was thinking, but all right. Anyways. Jewish country clubs were opening up then. This is the period when Groucho Marx, when he wanted to join the country club when his daughter wanted to go to the pool at the country club in Beverly Hills, which was restricted, they said, well, your daughter can't come to the pool because you're Jewish. So he says, well, my daughter's only half Jewish. Can she go up to her waist? It was also on that occasion that Groucho Marx supposedly said that I don't want to have any part of any club that'll have me as a member. But this was the idea that Jews are going to have their own country clubs and we're going to be all like everybody else and so on. And notice how in this montage, the Russia overshadows the Chacham, who's also receding. Okay? Below is an earlier, is a Jacob Steinhardt, by the way. Again, the soldier, this is 1923. This is very scary. Okay? This is a very scary piece. His Steinhardt's work in the 20s was very similar, has a lot of reminiscence. What does this remind you of? Munch. This looks like some kind of variation on the Scream. This sort of like very wavy kind of thing with the screaming. It's macabre, this thing. All right? But notice for a minute who's the Russia? What's the Russia wearing? A very specific kind of helmet. A German Imperial War helmet from World War I. Okay? Steinhardt was a German. Okay? In 1923, the released soldiers of the World War I, of the German army, organized as groups called the Freikorpskämpfer, the Free Corps fighters. And they were what the historian Richard Wade calls the vanguard of Nazism. because they were the ones who advocate, who advanced the idea of the stab in the back, and the Judens in unser Unglück, that the Jews are our misfortune, and so on and so forth. In fact, ultimately, many people who founded the Sturmabteilung, the SA, the stormtroopers of the Nazi Party, started out, Ernst Röhm, for example, started out as part of the Freikorps. And here you have a Jew who's more nationalist and more right-wing than the Goyim. And indeed, in 1932, in the German elections, there was a party that was led by a Jewish guy called Jews for Hitler. Why? He says he doesn't really mean the anti-Semitism, but he'll bring Ordnung. We don't know. I don't know what happened to him ultimately, but, you know, you can imagine. Okay? So that's a different kind of... That's the soldier with a twist. But it keeps shifting all the time. Take a look. I see I've only got a couple of minutes. Let's just take a look at one more example, and we'll sum up. I love this. This is Arthur Schick. Arthur Schick, sitting in his studio in Connecticut, comes up with three Frumme Yidden and a racetrack tout. You have three types of Haredim. By the way, what's the point here? What's the point? When you portray the three other sons as a Haredi, what as a classic Haredi, Eastern European, what does that express? I mean, you could do a lot with all this. I haven't even begun to scratch the surface. What message is that sending? It's a message that the modern Orthodox world has got to deal with. It's sending the message, especially with regard to the Chacham, that the only authentic type of Jew is an Eastern European Haredi type. That's the bugaboo of the modern Orthodox world, that our sense of inferiority. That they're the real Jews. By the way, that's one of the reasons why Haredi yeshivas get incredible amounts of non-Orthodox money. Because it was sort of like invest in your future, invest in the Jewish museum, whatever it is. They're the real Jews, and I'm going to buy my conscience by giving to this rabbi, that rabbi, and the other rabbi, and the blacker the hat, and the bigger the shtreimel, the better, because I feel better. That's the message that Schick was playing with. Schick is a very complicated artist, but notice who he's got is the Russia. The Russia... it's unbelievable. The Russia is wearing, he's, first of all, in this picture, this is a green suit. Okay? He's got a green suit, he's got a riding crop, he looks a little like FDR. He's got a cigarette and a cigarette holder, and he's going off to the races, and he's going to stand there with whoever. There's another version of this picture, in which you have a big zlob of a guy, with his belly hanging out, and he's got racetrack, tickets in his back pocket falling out. The same kind of idea. There are many more of these. For example, there's in the animated Haggadah that came out of Israel, Russia is a punkist. I'll just close with coming back to this original Israeli one from 1955. Here, let's look at the Russia. The Russia is interesting. The Russia, it's not clear what he's trying to get across. The Russia, assuming this is a religious Zionist person who's writing this Haggadah, Livni was a Frum guy, it may be his bourgeois attire. He's wearing a tie. No Israeli wore a tie at the time. It may be the image of what you have here is called Mao Migdal. He doesn't want any part of the Zionist enterprise. I sometimes wonder at the same time whether the image of the guard tower also means he's having a reaction to the Shoah. Whether that is also playing a role here. Because if you look at this right off, before you realize that it's a picture in Israel and that the pennant has the Magen David on it, it does in fact look like something out of the concentration camps. So I'm not sure if he wanted to give a double message here or not. The bottom line being that each one of these pictures is a snapshot in time of how a generation perceived itself, its concerns, its ideals, and what direction it's going. Okay? That expresses itself in the written commentary and in the pictorial illumination. And as the Kohen Gadol used to say on Yom Kippur, Yosei Mima Shekarati Katzuv Kan. There's a lot more than what I've brought here that's available. So when you open to take out the Haggadahs from the closet next week or the week after, Take time, not just, I give you permission, don't just read the text. Look at the pictures. Thank you.